the February 12th, 2008 meeting of the Public Records Exemptions Accountability Committee. If we could start with Cynthia, could we go around the table and introduce ourselves, please?
Cynthia Jordan, Attorney General's Office.
Frank?
Frank Martin.
Would you introduce yourself, please? Pressure button. This is a test.
Frank Garrett, journalism instructor at Peninsula College and former newspaper publisher.
Patience Rogge, Washington Library Association.
Tom Carr, Seattle City Attorney.
Jean Wilkinson, Attorney General's Office, counsel to the committee.
Ken Bunning, Seattle Post-Intelligencer. State Auditor Brian Sontag, the party to the committee.
Tim Ford, Attorney General's Office.
Ramsey Rammerman, Foster Pepper.
Rosalyn Marcus, Director of Legal Affairs, Office of Financial Management.
And I'd like to announce that anyone who wants to provide testimony, I'd ask you to sign in on the sign-in sheet so that we can have accurate spellings of names for our minutes. Thank you. You in your materials, you're provided with a copy of the minutes from the January 8th, 2008 meeting. Is there a motion to approve?
I'll move to approve.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? I've got a motion by Mr. Rammerman, a second by Mr. Ford. No discussion of proposed amendments. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes unanimously. The first item on the agenda is a discussion of the format for recommendations. At our last meeting, we worked on a draft that I had prepared of proposed amendments, a recommendation to the legislature for applications for public employment. After the meeting, a Senate staffer came up to me and made quite clear that my adequacies of bill drafting skills and pointed out that several of the things that I had intended or that the committee had intended through discussions were not present. Having been suitably chastised and realizing that the legislature pays many people to draft bills, and I'm not one of them, nor is anyone on this committee, I'm going to suggest that in the future we make our recommendations in the form of a recommendation that expresses the committee's intent without trying to put that in legislative language and leave that to the professionals. So I drafted, in between the two meetings, a recommendation which I thought laid out the sense of what the committee intended to do. And my suggestion would be that I would move that we replace the bill language that I had drafted and that was approved by an 8-1 vote with the recommendation language or any version of that, so that we can forward on to the legislature just a recommendation in plain English and leave to them any bill drafting that might be necessary. So I'm going to move that we substitute the material, the public records exemption recommendation on RCW 4256 250 sub 2 for the material adopted at our January 2nd, 2008 meeting.
And just to make sure all the committee members know how to identify the various pieces of paper you got, this is the chair's motion is talking about replacing has two sections of background and recommendation.
And actually, rather than jump right to that, does anyone have any feelings on the relative merits of either bill drafting language or recommendation language as our process? Ms. Martin?
I'd like to suggest that we go with the format that you've now introduced. As somebody who actually writes legislation for the governor, it is an art. And if we present something that isn't accurate, we could have unintended consequences. I think the legislature, if they accept our recommendations, is very able to turn our recommendations into bill language that would then have a better chance of actually meeting our intent and surviving a court challenge. So I would echo the chair's recommendation of not doing bill drafting language, but just putting our recommendations forth.
Mr. Garrett.
I like the approach. Do we get a chance to see what the bill drafters have drafted?
You mean after we send it?
Correct. Will they keep the intent intact, or will we be getting something uncertain out of this?
Well, that's sort of up to the legislature. I suppose that when we make our report, we could ask that any bills be sent to us for review at some point. But as you know, the legislative process rolls in its own way. We would always be able, I would suppose, to participate in the process and express our intent through the course of the legislative process if they were going to take up one of our recommendations.
That would be my next observation. We will be able to participate, or a representative of this committee will participate in hearings that relate to the information that we provide.
That would be my expectation.
Frank, the legislative website always has the original version of the bill available, even after it's been amended 100 times. So we'll be able to go back and see if they drafted what follows our intent. And I think we'll get a lot more done this way.
And any hearing on the bill would be open to the public. We would all be perfectly capable of going and testifying. We could offer our amendments. We could talk to, you know, legislative staff and let them know that their bill draft didn't express the intent of the committee. So I think there's a lot of opportunities to ensure that our intent is met by the legislation.
I would also agree. I think it makes a lot more sense to give recommendations. I would observe that I think that there may be times when we do want to draft something specifically, and that we shouldn't be precluded from doing that if we feel strongly about language. But I think as a whole, this makes sense. And I think it should also apply to the infant mortality that we've done. We should redo that. I'll redo that if we agree to go that way. And then also the minority report I prepared, I would redo.
I don't know that we need to take a vote on this, since it's just a procedural matter of the committee, but I get the sense that without objection that this is the way we'll proceed. The next item is similar, and that's should, once we make a recommendation, should we delay voting for a month? Is there any reason to allow people to have it, introduce it at one meeting and then wait and vote on it at the next meeting so people have a chance to think about it and research it and do what they want? Comes.
Well, I thought that was the idea back in September when we formed. I thought you made that observation. I like that idea. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend the January session of our committee meeting. That's no excuse, but that just things do come up. And I think that the committee should have a chance to digest what a recommendation might mean beyond these walls and after this discussion, just to be able to put it in their own perspective and come out with a vote that represents their view.
Mr. Ford.
Yeah, I think that's fine that we give advance notice of a proposed recommendation that might be adopted at a future meeting. I mean, we're supposed to send a report by November 15th, so there's always time to go back and revisit something if it needs fixing. I don't like staying on something too long or belaboring an exemption beyond the point that we have to. These are just recommendations, and the legislature will do with them what they will. But I also think perhaps it's important to get some of these recommendations to the legislature before November 15th, just because the legislative process is so front-loaded that if we really want to enact some legislative reform unanimously by the body, then we need to start the legislative process rolling prior to November 15th.
And Representative Kessler made it clear that we shouldn't wait till November 15th, that we can send their recommendations at any time for them to begin working on. The other thing that I like about waiting a month is that I've noted that we get email comments from the public through the course of the month, the time between our meetings, and it gives more people an opportunity to have input into the process than just the people who are able to show up, so that we can take that into account. We get many good ideas that way. So I do like the idea of having, it seems to be a more open process if we put something in writing, have it at a meeting, and then discuss it and have it for vote in the next meeting, so we can schedule things for discussion at one meeting and for vote at the next, so that people are clear about what's happening. And that way any changes can be incorporated. Mr. Bunting.
Mr. Chairman, I'm in general agreement with everyone else on that as a process and a policy normally, but there could be occasions when during the session, and we'll be working during the session next year, when we have a recommendation that we want to get to the legislature promptly, and I just like to just hold open the possibility that we'd have a process or a means if we all agree that there was an urgency to getting a recommendation to the legislature that we could do it.
That's a good comment. So I get the sense that with the possible exception of emergency process, we should be able to, we should, as a rule, as a general rule, discuss something at 1 month and then vote on it the next. Okay. Discussion of definition of exemption is the next item. That, unfortunately, is something Senator Klein wanted to discuss, and he's not with us at this moment. So without the legislators, I think perhaps we should hold that. Maybe we should just go on to voting to remove their exemption, and since they're not here, and I'm kidding. That would be a joke. Applications for public employment. The draft summary was sent to you. Perhaps what we should do is apply this rule. Now you've got this in language for the first time. I drafted it last week. Perhaps we should discuss it today, make any changes that the committee wishes, and then vote on it next week, next month. Let's give everybody fair notice. We did receive several comments, which were emailed out to you from the public on this subject. So is there any discussion on that?
Mr. Chairman, I think it captures the sense of what we discussed, and unless some of the public comment we've received has changed someone's mind, the language seems what we ought to talk about next month.
There was
Mr. Ammerman.
There's two things that I saw that I didn't think were captured in here. I think the first one was the timing of disclosure. My understanding from the discussion was that we were talking about disclosing applications after the hiring decision has been made as opposed to before the hiring decision was made. And I think that the draft that was actually drafted didn't capture that successfully, I don't think, but this also doesn't. So I think if there is a timing issue, obviously I voted against this anyways, but I think there was a timing aspect that we discussed. Also, we had talked about limiting it to the finalists as opposed to all applications. And again, this doesn't capture that. So if those are things that what we want to be in the recommendation, I think we should add some language into there.
I agree that the idea was to limit it to the finalists. And I believe my sense was that it was after the process was concluded. And I can certainly make changes to this to incorporate those.
Yeah, and this is a copy of what the committee voted on the last time. So you can, and that is in there, that it was going to be released after the selection had been made. So.
The one thing on that language, it wasn't, the way it's written, it could be read as after the selection of the finalists was made or after the selection of the actual hiring decision was made. So just so we're clear, make sure if we're clear on the recommendations which we mean.
Other comments? Other things? Is there anyone who believes that it should be after the selection of the finalists, as opposed to after the selection of the person that's being hired? What Mr. Ryman is suggesting was that the records, the applications of the finalists should be available. Well, Mr. Ryman is actually opposing this, but the suggestion is that what his understanding of the committee's sense is that the applications for the finalists would be available after the position was filled, that is, after the final the selection was made by the appointing authority. Would anyone prefer for us that this to be written so that it is the finalists after the finalists are selected, but before the final decision is made? Ms. Rogge?
I agree with Mr. Ramerman.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Grant?
I need some help. A school board has 8 candidates. They have said publicly that they will narrow their selection process to 3. This is for superintendent of schools. Now, apply this. When those 3 are selected, as finalists, will their information be available?
Not at that point. That's the question I'm asking. What Mr. Ramaman's suggestion is that the information will be available after the superintendent is chosen. Then the public would have access to the applications of those three people.
Okay. I cannot agree with that.
Okay, so your preference would be that it be written so that the material was available after the finalists were chosen, but during the selection process. Is that correct?
If we're going to prescribe it to that detail, yes, that's what I would prefer.
Mr. Bunting, did you want to ask?
Mine is a question. What is current law right now on this exemption?
The current law is that they're not available at all.
They're totally...
Applications for public employment are exempt. And as I wrote in the little background piece, when the legislation was originally drafted, it had an exclusion to the exemption for executive positions, for finalists of executive positions. And that language was vetoed.
Okay. By which governor?
I don't recall.
No, we don't care. Yeah.
And I don't think it matters. And so the recommendation, it may matter at some ends of the table. But so my guess is that it wasn't the current governor.
It wasn't the current governor.
No, okay. It was.
In any event.
Let me get the date.
In any event.
I'll have it here in just a second.
I agree with Mr.
Garrett. So Gardner.
Thank you. I agree with Mr. Garrett, but I don't know whether we've got the votes here to carry that day. It's an improvement either way.
Well, this is for discussion. I will draft it with two possible inclusions, and we can take a vote on those when we vote on it. Mr. Ford?
You know, I don't want to further belabor the legal analysis here, but you're correct that under the Public Records Act, currently, these applications would not be disclosable. I have to point out that there is some debate in the legal community as to whether under the Open Public Meetings Act that the selection of a finalist would be permitted in executive session, as to whether that is a final action that is prohibited in executive session. So, I mean, I don't want to go down a whole bunch of legal wonkish analysis, but certainly I have, and my predecessor, Greg Overstreet, has erred on the side of interpreting the Open Public Meetings Act to require the selection of finalists to be in an Open Public Meeting Act. We have not concluded that any particular agency has violated the act, but we have always encouraged agencies, in our opinion, to do it in an Open Public Meetings Act. I'm sorry,
of course,
Open Public Meeting.
We're talking about the Public Records Act.
Yes.
And so this, even if the selection were made in the public, the application wouldn't necessarily be available. And so we have a big enough job with trying to deal with public records.
I understand
that.
I'm
not opening up.
And so I questioned you before I started. I did not mean to further convolute the thing, but there is
a
dispute in the legal community as to whether this information should be public.
Okay.
But there's a dispute in the legal community about that.
Remember your microphone, Mr. Ramaman. Okay, so what we'll do is we've got this drafted. There seems to be a split on the committee. We have a minority, not a minority, we have a quorum of the committee here, but I'm hesitant to draft it one way or the other or even take a vote on it. So I will draft it with option A and option B, and we can put those on the table for a vote at our next meeting. But there is the agreement that all we're recommending is the finalist resumes. Now, as I pointed out at the meeting, last meeting, or someone pointed out, in the vetoed language of 4256-252, there was language that said that there had to be at least three finalists. And I didn't feel that it was this committee's job to tell people how many finalists they needed to select. And so if the legislature wanted to do that, that's one thing. But we're a records committee, not a hiring committee. And so I didn't feel comfortable putting that in. That was my sense. It doesn't necessarily have to be the sense of the committee. But the number of finalists seems to me to be a matter of choice. And you can have two, you can have 10. But if you designate them as the finalists before the selection, you have to disclose their applications after you are at some point. And that point will be discussed later. Mr. Garrod.
Agreed. I try and look at this thing from the perspective of the communities, and I come back and I think, wow, if the governor was thinking of an appointee to the Department of Licenses, would I be as vigorously concerned as I would be living in Port Townsend, where the school board is a lot closer to me, and I am interested. And let's face it, school boards tend to be pretty good in general about letting us know who those finalists are. In fact, they bring them on board, and they're interviewed in front of the Kiwanis Club and the Rotary Club. But there's a lot of public involvement in that process. Whereas I wonder as to how much public involvement there really is in selecting the director of the Department of Licenses. So there is a bit of a separation here or a difference between those appointees for high positions at our local level and appointees to high positions at a statewide level.
And frankly, I think that that's one of the difficulties in drafting that I want to avoid. My view of the language that was in the original bill that was vetoed was that it wasn't clear who was covered. And it may have covered virtually everyone. And I think one of the issues that I've heard raised in testimony and in emails was this question of, does it cover department chairs at colleges and community colleges? I can understand it would be my intent that it cover the head of a college and the head of the president of a university, the president of a community college, but not necessarily the chair of the Department of Biology. And the prior language did seem to cover the chair of any department, no matter how you designated it. So, and I see that gets to your point as well. But I do believe that this would be a good change for us to recommend. Mr. Ford.
Yeah, my understanding that when you were talking about executive positions, you were not talking about multi-member boards or committees, but you're rather the director of an agency.
That's my intent. I've tried to capture in this and in the language I drafted the concept of someone who is the highest person at a particular agency that they're responsible for. And that to try, again, this is why I'm not drafting bills. To try to get that into bill language is a difficult concept, and I'm not sure they did a very good job the last time. So there was some doubt. All right. So we will have that for vote at our next meeting. Infant mortality review exemption. Mr. Rammerman did and Mr. Ford, I think you participated as well, a nice job of summarizing some suggestions for that. You received them by email. And always, before we leave public employment, I wanted to add, Mr. Rammerman had drafted a minority report, and of course you'll have the opportunity to submit one to the next and to discuss the vote on the next one as well.
Thank you.
The Sunshine Committee's recommendations on child mortality review exemption approved January 8th. Now this was in the form of a recommendation.
Yeah, and I think that we should update this to not try and be bill drafting again. I think that some of the comments that we heard were concerned about, you know, whether we were actually doing what we were trying to do. And I think that, again, this is another example where I'm not a bill drafter. I think that I would propose that I do this again and just be a little more explicit on what our recommended changes are without trying to draft the language and follow that format.
So Mr. Rammerman, is it your preference to bring this back in a different form at the next meeting?
Yes, it is. And if the committee wants to vote on it now, we can do that and just get it done with. But I think that this is a perfect example of where we're better off giving recommendations than trying to be bill drafters.
I believe we approved it at our last meeting, so we don't need to vote again. But if you want to draft a summary of the committee's intent, along the form that I did for the applications for public employment, that would be great, and then we can vote at the next meeting to have that replace our prior vote.
Yeah, that's what I propose.
And does anybody have any objection to that process? And then we would, I guess, vote it at the meeting after that. So we'd have another 2 month meetings to consider that. Excellent. Okay. I understand someone who wanted to speak about this. Please come forward, ma'am. Uh, And I apologize for not acting on this today, but we welcome and we'll listen to your comments. And you have to hit the button on the microphone to make it work.
Hi. I'm Hallie Johnson. I am the secretary of the Washington State SIDS Foundation. Deborah Robinson was planning on being here tonight, but she has a bereavement group that she runs tonight, and so she asked me to come in her place. I didn't realize that this had already been voted on to go ahead with this changing of the wording of the RCW. Our hope is that you won't change the wording. It's our understanding that the Sunshine Committee feels that the current wording of these RCWs will impede law enforcement investigations. Our experience has been opposite. We found that the review process being a separate review does not impact police investigations unless it is found during the review process that there may have been system or agency issues in play that failed to protect the child, such as a police officer goes out for a welfare check, finds nothing wrong, child then somehow dies from an assault. Was it the police that were responsible? Was there a CPS referral to be able to hold them accountable? That's the only time. Since 1999, Washington CDR teams have reviewed more than 1,600 unexpected deaths of children. Teams determined that half of these deaths were preventable. In 2000, 89% of unexpected deaths of Washington children were reviewed by CDR teams, and now in 2003, this dropped down to 29%. That's because in the 2003-2005 Washington state budget funding, the CDR's funding was eliminated. Only 17 of the original 13 teams still meet using alternative funding. Since 2003, data collected has been neither comprehensive nor statewide. There are currently at least three more teams that would like to begin doing CDRs again. We believe that the integrity and the intention of this law was vague for a reason. By redefining these CRWs, this could place further constraints and could potentially stall CDR indefinitely. This may impact our abilities to serve families. CDRs allow us to freely identify prevention strategies. Data from child death reviews help us understand how and why children die and allow us to accurately track factors that can increase the risk of childhood death. Data is used to take information that can prevent future deaths and improve the health and safety of children. In Washington, CDR data provides more information on child deaths than what can be obtained from a death certificate alone. For example, CDR data is a key source of information on shaken baby syndrome, deaths due to choking, deaths in unlicensed daycare facilities, deaths associated with substance abuse, youth suicide risk factors, co-sleeping infant deaths, and association with substance abuse and other risk factors. They have helped improve death scene investigation, develop and implement policies, and promote legislation, identify gaps in community services. Using the information from CDRs has helped obtain grants, improve communication and interagency collaboration. It's also used to produce reports and fact sheets such as the Washington State Childhood Injury Report, the Maternal and Child Health Data Report, and the Community Norms About Child Abuse. Between 2003 and 2005, there were 2,234 deaths of children in Washington State. This means that each of these years, there was an average of 24 children out of every 100,000 children that died. King Pierce in Snohomish County, they're larger with between 40 to 56 deaths per 100,000. Every one death affects 100 people. So I'm sitting here as a SIDS mother myself, and I couldn't prevent my child's death, but I can help prevent others. Through these numbers that we get from the CDRs, that's where we get our information to be able to know who we need to talk to for prevention and education. Native Americans, Blacks, lower income. That's where we get our information for our grants for our Cribs for Kids program, our safety baby kits. Our fear is that by changing this wording, that it will make the ones that are still doing CDRs, the teams, and the ones that want to not do it because they're afraid of their exemptions and that they wouldn't be allowed to speak between agencies, which they need to be able to have the free-flowing information to be able to find out that it was bed sharing, that it may have been overheating, that helmet laws. I mean, all of these things go in together. That's all.
I think that our intent here, I think everyone here fully agreed and recognized the intent of the statute and the CDRs and want to promote that. Our concern, actually, that we talk, although we talk about law enforcement, the concern that we were more, the thing we're more concerned about with this is that the actual language in the exemption seems to apply to any record or document supplied or maintained for the purposes of a child mortality review, which we felt was overbroad because it was just any document, doesn't talk about any confidentiality issues necessary for that document. And so the goal of the recommendation of the committee was based on trying to focus the exemption on protecting the confidentiality issues for families that are participating in this review, protect the medical records. But if you've got other documents that don't involve confidential information, let them out. Because the other problem with this statute is it seems that the only thing that is disclosed is a final report, if a final report is ever published. And so I think that we've been hoping to get some guidance, and this is the closest we've gotten to someone actually giving us guidance on what it is. So we are bumbling through this, but we do feel that the exemption right now, while serving a good goal, is overbroad and can be narrowed in a way that doesn't interfere with the ability to do the reviews. So I'm sure, I speak for myself, but I think probably all of us would like someone who actually does this to give us some guidance on what we're doing with the statute, because we all are in agreement it's overbroad, and we're all in agreement that these do really good things, and we just want to make it work together.
Yeah, like I said, our fear is just that by narrowing down, that it might discourage new CDR teams from starting, because as it stands now, the only, it was Pierce and Kitsap County are the only ones that continued to do CDRs after they lost the funding. King County is now doing it again. Snohomish County is about to start up. We're afraid of discouraging any more teams, and from the teams that are just about to start or the ones that have just started again from starting to do the reviews because of fear of what they're disclosing and because of the confidentiality that you're adding into the language.
Have you had a chance to look at the proposal?
Yes.
Is there anything in here in the proposed revised language that you think is bad? Any specific you want to draw to our attention?
Well, it's not so much a specific item. We're just hoping that it gets left alone and the way it is. The way that it was originally written, it was just written very vaguely. And so that was what we were, well, at the SIS Foundation, that's what we're hoping to keep. It's just the vagueness that it can go along with any agency that they wouldn't, you know, it's not set and defined of, no, we can't give you this, and no, we can't give you this type of thing until there was a final report.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you.
We're scheduled to take a break on our agenda, but I'm not tired yet.
Working so efficiently.
So I think perhaps we should move on. Yes, we have exemption. We have some more exemptions related to agriculture that we had not considered before, and so Ms. Wilkerson has prepared some background for you, which she received and which she'll present. Mr. Garrett,
could I play catch up for a moment, or since we have some time?
Yeah.
Who drafted the recommendations?
Mr. Rammerman and Mr. Ford.
Could you please explain original RCW 7051703? I mean, just help guide me through this. Section 3C, paragraph C. Is that existing language? Thank you. That was quick.
I don't know exactly how to address this, but one thing that we seem to be running up with is a lot of people saying they don't want to change anything. And I don't know how, but we need guidance from the entities that actually do these things when we're making these, for these detailed in agriculture is the same thing. We need we need guidance on what these do and what they don't do. And I don't know, but we seem to be getting don't change anything, which doesn't give us anything to work with. And I'm not sure what other resources we can have, obviously. I guess I'm just identifying a problem, but I don't know the answer to it.
Mr. Ford.
My recollection of one of our earlier meetings was that the intent of the statute was to assist the state in identifying factors that could reduce both infant and child mortality, and that that might be promoted with further disclosure of some reports so long as confidentiality was maintained for the identities of the people who are forthcoming with information. So that was the broad goal, was to approach the disclosure issue from the perspective of how we can improve the functioning of these mortality review committees.
Further discussion? Ms. Wilkins, you're on.
Okay. Are you done with child mortality review?
For the present.
And just so it's clear for me, Mr. Rammerman, you're going to, you feel you have enough information to go ahead and put together a proposal for the next meeting?
Yes.
Yeah. The next item on the agenda are what I believe to be the final three statutes that are exemptions, actually four statutes that are exemptions that fall under the category of agriculture. So I've lost count of how many we've looked at so far. But I believe we've now identified the final four, and part of the information that Cynthia emailed to you are the legislative history packets that I put together for each statute. So I'll go over those. Also, we just passed out something that staff from the Department of Agriculture brought here today. As you recall, in November, the Department of Agriculture put together a binder of information with the statutes and with information that the department has about how various statutes are implemented. And the single sheet document with some highlights, it's two-sided, that goes into the binder that you already received from the Department of Agriculture to explain two of the four exemptions that we're going to be discussing tonight. The first one is RCW 1565-510. This one relates once again to commodity commissions. We've already heard presentations from the Farm Bureau and from representatives of commodity commissions themselves about the function of a commodity commission. We've had a representative of the Apple Commission and the Beef Commission explain what the commissions do for producers in that area. The statute that I've pulled tonight exempts from disclosure information furnished to the director of the Department of Agriculture. This is very similar to the exemption in the Public Records Act 4256, Section 380, subsections 3 and 5. The one thing that's notable, I think, about RCW 1565-510 is how old it is. It predates the public disclosure laws. It goes back to 1961. This exemption does not exempt from disclosure aggregate information. It exempts information that identifies an individual. So in this case, that would be an individual producer. But it does not exempt from disclosure reports that collect and aggregate information, nor does it exempt from disclosure information about a person who has violated a commodity commission's marketing agreement. We don't have anything new and different to learn about the purpose for the exemption than what we've already heard. Laws that are this old, in those days, the legislature did not produce a written record of legislative intent. So for the intent here, we can only guess that it's similar to the intent that applied when the legislature in 1996 adopted similar exemptions in the Public Records Act. And based on the testimony that we've heard in the past, producers form these commodity commissions because there's good things they can do to promote their products, particularly outside of the state of Washington by banding together. They agree to be assessed certain fees so that these programs can happen. But in order to create their commission and assess fees, producers have to give up information about how much they're producing, so business information, and producers want to keep that confidential, but they also want the benefits of the marketing programs that are financed by those assessments. So do you want me to just go ahead and go through the legislative history? I see we have a representative from the Farm Bureau here, and we have someone from the Department of Agriculture, but shall we just present all the legislative history first? Okay. Because the next two statutes, you have one packet of information because these two statutes were adopted at the same time. The next two statutes are something new and different that we haven't seen in previous exemptions that we've taken a look at. These two statutes, RCW 2209-040 and 045, these are statutes that relate to warehouse operators and grain dealers. These types of businesses need to be licensed by the Department of Agriculture, and as part of the licensing process, these businesses submit financial statements to the Department of Agriculture. The legislative history seems to suggest, this is not a direct quote, you kind of have to read between the lines, but the department regulates warehouse operators and grain dealers in order to provide protection to the producers who use those services. And so, therefore, the department has statutory authority to require that these producer or that these businesses have a certain financial standing, minimum net worth, in order to obtain a license. So it's for the protection of the people who use these services that businesses show before they get their license that they're adequately capitalized. These statutes were enacted in 1987, and there is a final bill report, which on page 2 talks about, this particular bill covered a lot of different topics, but on page 2 is the explanation for the new statutes adopted in 1987 dealing with grain dealers and warehouses. Okay, the fourth statute that we're bringing up for the first time tonight is RCW 4223-270. And this also has to do with commodity commissions. This statute actually is sort of the analog to RCW 4256-380 sub 5. So in the Public Records Act itself, there's an exemption for certain information. And then in the statute that deals specifically with the Department of Agriculture, the exemption is stated again. This exemption exempts financial and commercial information supplied by producers to the Department of Agriculture with respect to export market development projects. And it only exempts this information from disclosure when it is identifiable to an individual producer. This exemption was enacted in 1996, so there is a bill report that discusses this. It's a two-page bill report, and there's the second paragraph of the bill report, the second full paragraph, talks about the exemption. It's not very informative, but that is what the legislature stated at the time it enacted this. So unless there's any questions of me, I think a lot of this is very similar to the types of exemptions we've seen in the agricultural area in the past. So in terms of purpose behind exemptions, it's news that the committee's heard on a couple of previous occasions.
Any questions? Any public comment? Seeing none. Joy, Jean, you can stay there. Oh. You're the next item on the agenda as well, right?
Are we going to have a discussion amongst us? Or we have?
Do you want to have a discussion?
I would actually like a little discussion just on this. I think that we obviously have Frank's comments that have been put forth on this. I don't know if we've gotten any closer to a solution on how to, if we're going to do anything to these agriculture exemptions and what level of streamlining we could do. I think that from a user standpoint, gathering the agricultural exemptions in one spot would be helpful. I think clearly identifying them in the Public Records Act as agricultural exemptions. I mean, the statute leads off, but a little more, instead of just saying all records gathered pursuant to X statute, say, you know, all records related to blah gathered pursuant to X statute, so that someone reading the act can have a little more information of what it's about. Would be two non-substantive things that we could do to make the act more reader-friendly. I am, as far as the what they covered and what they don't, I don't have any real ideas for changing it, but I do think we could make recommendations to make the act easier to use by gathering these all in one and clearly labeling them in the statute.
Mr. Gorod, did you have other comments? I guess I'm sort of taxed by trying to understand. I obviously don't understand the business, and I can't say what needs to be confidential. That's a legislative, but I do have a sense that these are very broad and that they are all over the place, and that gathering them is a, and that one of our charges was to somehow reduce the number of exemptions, and that seems to bother people. I think protecting confidential business information, protecting confidential financial information, protecting competitive advantages, those are all worthy goals that I have no trouble with, but as you, I am troubled by how difficult the act is to use. And one of my questions, though, is, you know, we see the frequent duplication where the language is in both the Public Records Act and in the enabling legislation. It would seem that it doesn't need to be in both places, but having had arguments where it wasn't, and you get the question, which act trumps? And so I can understand why, for safety's sake, someone might want it in both places. Perhaps we should make clear that an exemption is an exemption, If it's in the Public Record Act, it exempts the material, and it doesn't need to be placed also in the enabling legislation, and that that all exemptions will should be in the Public Records Act, and that they would trump anything, any other language, and that if the legislature wanted to make something publicly available, they should amend the Public Records Act to remove an exemption and not just place the language in. Although I'm not sure how that would work. You'd always have the argument. For non-lawyers, you have later legislation always trumps prior legislation, right? Because it's the same legislative body. So I have a Public Records Act exemption, but the legislature subsequently requires that new material be produced and kept. That then becomes a public record. Does that trump the prior? So being a good lawyer, I'd say, well, put the exemption there too.
The duplicative nature of the exemptions is one issue, but the exemptions that aren't even in the Public Records Act at all and only elsewhere is another issue. I think at least on this, we could recommend to the legislature that they gather them and give a little better description of what they're about in the Public Records Act and just gather them all together. So I think that we should at least consider making that recommendation to the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, some of these exemptions, or not, some of this exemption, these exemptions, proprietary information, financial records, business information, relate to other, so many other elements of that we're going to be considering here. Help me out. Are there definitions of each of these items in our RCWs? Is there a definition of what proprietary information is? What is that definition? Is there a clear definition of what financial information is required of the state that would be protected?
I mean, my original sense coming into this is I thought we could be able to come up with some better guidance, some universal guidance on this. But at least my impression from hearing from the Department of Agriculture is that some of these, they don't use the term consistently, and some of the programs are so detailed and they attach that very detailed information that it's really hard to come up with a universal meaning without looking at what the statute collects and what it doesn't. I think it would be, I mean, if we could come up with something, I think that would be great. I don't think there is anything in the that's a universal definition of these topics at all. But I don't want to hamstring any of these programs by us coming up with too narrow of a definition. And I am concerned about, especially with some of the detailed information they collect, that any definition that we come up won't be sufficiently broad enough.
Well, considering the discretionary elements that are in the several of these Department of Agricultural RCWs, I don't know that we're hamstringing the department from carrying its mission out if we don't do anything about them. If we continue to let this continue, we're not hamstringing anybody. When it comes to some of the more technical stuff that even I don't understand, that that relates to fertilizers and other products that are placed on property to make things grow better or make critters fatter, that to me does have a direct implication on the public's health and safety. And I have a big problem letting those types of elements slide by unless someone wants to describe why it has to be a proprietary nature or a trade secret or whatever. I have a problem with that part of it. What Mr. Ramman suggested way back in October, was it? About defining or redefining in RCW, gotta get my glasses. 4256 270, all new. I don't have a problem with that. But I will continue, I guess, to have a bit of a difficulty, and I hope it's not just simply misunderstanding the intent of the laws that relate to the Department of Agriculture regarding fertilizers and the other elements that herbicides, pesticides, all of those things that are applied to a farmland or agricultural land that does have a direct effect, or could have a direct effect, on the health and safety of the rest of us humans around the state of Washington. That's really my concern. My concern is not necessarily the generic protection, if you will, of proprietary information, financial records. I respect that. Having been in business, I don't want to tell people all of the details of how my business operated or what its financial situation was at all times. But with regards to these other elements that I tried to describe in my little memo, those things remain a concern to me.
So I see two different senses in the committee then. My view is that I don't understand this well enough to mess with it, and I don't see a policy reason to do that. But Mr. Garrod, you seem to have a policy reason to change some of the exemptions to make some more material public than is currently public today. Is that correct?
Well, maybe I see this as some information that is now protected should be public. And it's that concern that drives my interest in this. And I hope it's just not mine. I think that things that affect the public is probably interested in. Things that affect the Department of Agriculture and how it operates, I don't think the public has much interest in that. And I don't know that the public has a great deal of interest in measuring the financial abilities or inabilities of a farm owner or a feedlot operator, how they operate. I don't think the public has that interest, and I don't know that it even deserves to have that information. At least I agree with Mr. Rammerman on that part. But I do have, and will continue to have, a concern about the accessibility to records that deal with, that are now exempt in some manner or another, that deal with formulas in some cases, trade secrets in some cases. I guess I have a concern about the discretionary ability of the department head to deal with some exemptions by choice, I hope not by whim. So what do we want to do with it? What would I suggest? What would I recommend? Since I'm not a lawyer and I don't draft bills. Some of them are lawyers, so can. I guess that I would like to see something drafted more particular to my interests so that we can consider it, other than the generalities that I offered in my memo. I'd like to see us draft something that deals with a consolidation or elimination of exemptions that deal with ingredients that are placed on farmlands or that go into the critters, animals that end up on our table. I guess I would like to see the availability of records that. Let's back up a little bit. I think I'd like to see the elimination of the judgment quality that is offered in some sections of the RCWs for the Department of Agriculture, and maybe that may be language that's in other statutes as well for other departments. I don't know, but I'd like to see that tightened up. I think we should be able to suggest to the legislature or recommend to the legislature that the language that they provide for exemptions to the Public Records Act must be specific. And we don't need to have some of this material or some of this language so general that we sit around a table and have to continue to debate it or discuss it. Even new legislation that we're seeing coming through now, we're going to be faced with new exemptions next year, and the language will be just as vague.
So perhaps we can go forward like this. Perhaps, Mr. Rammerman, if you could draft just general recommendations for the committee to discuss on your proposal to streamline. And, Mr. Garrod, if you could just put some of your thoughts in writing, I'd be happy to work with you to put them in the form of a recommendation to the committee that we could circulate before the next meeting. And it may not carry the day, but I agree with you, but I'm certainly happy to help you to put it in a form that we can get it before the committee and actually have a discussion and vote.
No, I'm not interested in carrying a day. I am interested in having a table discussion of this And not to change my mind, I think we deserve to apply the same interest to the Department of Agriculture's presentation as we would in any others, that's all. And I think the outcome should be one that serves our purpose.
But is my methodology proceeding forward good?
Thank you for offering.
So if you want to send me an email with your ideas, I will try to put them in recommendations. I'll send them back to you.
Let's do it.
And we'll work like that.
Appreciate that, Tom.
Mr. Bunting.
And if I could just echo, I mean, for one thing, I think we need to recognize that some of the language that Frank is raising concerns about is not in the Public Records Act, but in other exemptions found elsewhere in the law. The points that you've raised that resonate with me is whether or not there is a clear definition of proprietary information. I don't understand it either, and maybe we could ask the legislature to review that. The financial data is pretty clear to me, I mean, because it sort of relates to what they report is exempt, and that even makes sense. And, you know, trade information regarding competitive advantage makes sense as well. The other question that I would, you know, put before the legislature as a recommendation is maybe some sort of review of whether or not you raised points that some of the language is discretionary. The Director of Agriculture may withhold if he chooses to withhold with no definition of why he's withholding. And it seems to me that clarity is something the legislature might do in a review. Maybe we can't solve those things here because we're not gonna hold, you know, extensive hearings. I mean, we've had great input from our friends from agriculture and the industries and the like, but the legislature is more equipped to look at these things. But I think the points about clarity of what is proprietary information and an understanding of why there's discretionary ability to withhold is something that would be an improvement.
On the discretionary point, I think it's a large number. I think the default for exemptions is they're discretionary. And so I think that we need, when we're talking about discretion, I mean, I think we want public agencies to have the discretion to not assert an exemption. And so when we're talking about discretion, I think that we need to keep that in mind. I don't think we're going to be able to define factors on when they should assert an exemption or not, but there's just broad discretion. And so I think the discretion in these ones is a little different, but we just, when we're talking about discretion, we need to keep that in mind, that majority of exemptions are discretionary.
Mr. Bunting.
Well, I'm just going to partially agree, partially disagree. I mean, the exemptions are discretionary. Throughout the law, though, it is not discretionary on what must be disclosed in some other areas. So, I mean, while the exemption might be discretionary, in some cases, disclosure is required under the Act, and I think we can look at it that way.
I think it's a different kind of discretion that we're seeing here. I mean, an agency can always waive an exemption, but an agency doesn't have the authority to create an exemption. That seems to be what's embodied in some of this, that the head of the agency gets to decide what's exempt and what's not, and that's not true in a very many of the places that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I do think it's different. I just wanted to note, when we're talking about discretion, to not make sure we are eliminating the discretion that agents already have to waive all the exemption or most exemption.
I'm a little confused because I thought in the response from the director of the Department of Agriculture that they were saying that sometimes applicants' marks information is confidential, and the director has the discretion to tell the applicant that she doesn't believe the information is confidential and is going to release it. So the discretion is used in the opposite way, saying that, no, this isn't confidential, I'm going to release it unless you get an injunction. So I thought that was part of the discretion given, which actually makes things more disclosable, not less.
Thank you. Further comments? Okay. Ms. Jackson, welcome. Sorry about your long trip. We're going to move on to, unless there's further discussion, and the committee agrees with that plan for heading forward. And so my plan would be to have these recommendations circulated before our March meeting, have discussion and finalize the recommendations at the March meeting, and have a vote at the April meeting on these two recommendations, assuming that there's anything to recommend. And that will close off our discussion on the agricultural exemptions. Okay?
Thank you.
Exemptions related, item number 8, exemptions related to public employment.
By way of background, in, I believe it was in November, the committee decided to go ahead and, after considering the agricultural exemptions, move on to the category of exemptions that relate to personal information in public employment. And so far, the one exemption dealing with applications and resumes has been extensively discussed. So tonight, we're moving on to two very specific exemptions that are somewhat similar to the exemption the committee's been discussing since October. The first one has to do with a state board called the Workforce Training and Education Coordinating Board. This is a board that appoints an executive director. And the statute that sets up the board and its duties states that one of the board's duties is to appoint a director. The director has to be appointed off of a list. Representatives of business and labor get together, come up with a list of 3 candidates, submits the list to the board, and the board has to select the director off of that list. There is, and the statute states that the lists compiled by the board is not subject to public disclosure. So it's different than the exemption you've been studying before that protects the application materials. This one protects the lists of finalists, essentially. One thing that I would like to point out, when I did the worksheet that's the first page of your packet, the board itself, the Workforce Training Board, had not been notified that the committee was going to consider this tonight. In the meantime, that committee, that board has, in fact, been notified. And the executive director of the committee did send an email, which Cynthia circulated to everybody earlier today. I don't know if everybody was in their office today to get their copy of it. And I think Cynthia has extra copies of it if anybody didn't have a chance to look at that today.
Jean, can I just ask a clarifying question? Did you say that the committee selects the director?
Right. Now, yeah, and now it's, I'm wondering whether we have a situation where a statute has been amended. But it's
because I understand the governor selects the director.
Right, that's right. Excuse me. Yeah, the governor selects off a list submitted by the board. And the board works with representatives of labor and business to put together the list of names. This is an exemption from 1991. In 1991, the legislature put together this board. The impetus for the board, as reflected in the final bill report that's in your packet, was that the legislature was concerned that there is fragmentation in the training system and that a coordinating board would be useful to have a more coordinated approach to training the workforce. And this board deals with programs at vocational colleges and community colleges. The legislative history does not indicate why this list of names should be confidential. In a way, I suppose it may be redundant to the exemption that we've been studying for the last few months. And why there was a specific exemption enacted is not explained in the legislative history. Maybe the people who drafted the bill just didn't understand that there would be some protection for the information about the people who are being considered for that position. So that, in the absence of anything more illuminating in the legislative history, is what I can offer. There was some discussion about someone coming in and giving public comment tonight, but apparently that didn't happen unless that's what Mr. Thompson is here for. So
he's shaking his head.
He's shaking his head. Okay. So I can answer questions, or the committee can discuss where to go with this one.
Given that these two are very similar, why don't we hear about the second one and then talk about them together? Is that it?
That makes sense to me. And I agree with Mr. Rammerman. The second one is virtually the same thing as the first. It has to do with a different board. This one started out in 1989 as it was called the Committee for Outdoor Recreation. Within the last couple of years, the name has been changed to the Recreation and Conservation Funding Board. Here again, I will point out that the worksheet needs an update. Since the worksheet was distributed to you, OFM was able to contact this board to let the board know that the committee was going to be taking public comment on this exemption this evening. And however, we did not receive any feedback in written form anyway. This is a committee that makes funding decisions about parks and other recreation projects. There are certain state monies and federal monies that can be given out in the form of grants to different parks around the state. And this committee consists of some public officials and some members of the public, and they review grant applications and decide which parks and recreation projects are going to get to the top of the list and get grant funds. Here again, we have a bill report that talks about the mission of the committee, but the bill report does not indicate why this list of candidates for director of the board is not going to be subject to public disclosure.
Just to clarify, the chair of the board did send a letter to Mr. Carr, and he may not have received it, but
okay.
It was also sent to the governor's office, and they forwarded it to me by email. So
okay.
You will have a letter from the chair, Val Ogden.
Does it shed any light on why the list should be not subject to disclosure, in his opinion?
It's I could pass this around, it's a page and a half letter, so.
Mr. Chairman, can I?
Yes, Mr. Bunning.
My recommendation in both these cases would be that we communicate by email with the directors of that the first commission and this one, and ask them for their understanding or reason of why the list of finalists for appointment isn't subject to public disclosure, and consider it at the next meeting. But I would start with the recommendation that they ought to be in keeping with the policy we just adopted with regard to public appointment in general.
Of course, the difference I see is that these are volunteer positions, not the head of agencies. And
These are not volunteer positions. Okay. These are paid positions.
I'm sorry, but they're committees. They're not the head of agencies. What we've adopted so far, at least what we're recommending so far, is the directors of agencies and the people involved in that process. These are slightly different. This is a list of people recommended to fill in the chairs of committees.
I guess I understand that, but then the persons making that final list and then from which the appointment of ink could be all brother-in-laws for all I know. And I just seems to me that I don't understand. I mean, maybe the agency heads will tell us something that will shed new light on it and give us a reason to understand why they're not subject to disclosure, but I'm not getting it right now.
Mr. Ford, and then Mr. Rahman.
I think that
Marcus.
The director's positions that are being filled would be for an agency position, but the lists are compiled by a committee. So I don't want to confuse our terms here between committee and agency, but there is a committee that compiles a list and gives suggestions to the governor how to appoint a director for an agency.
Mr. Rahman.
I think that the comments that we got, I can't find it now, but we did get comments from the head of one of the agencies before this, and I think she did a good job of spelling out the purpose of this exemption, which is to encourage, and that we get the same comments in the letter that's being passed around, which is to encourage a robust, large pool of applicants. And the example we got in this comment was specifically the current head saying that she wouldn't have applied but for this exemption because of the endangering her current position if she was known she was applying for other jobs. And I think that's why the exemption for all application material should be exempt. I think this is a further example of this. And I think so we do have the justification behind these. I do think that these two exemptions are duplicative. This is application material, compiling a list of the applicants that would be covered under the current statute. Our amendments may then make it so it's not exempt from disclosure, but I think this is a good example of two statutes that shouldn't be elsewhere and should be gathered in as one, and this is an example of two exemptions we could get rid of without changing the actual effect of it.
Ms. Marcus.
I have to think about whether that was true, but if you wanted to hear from other people, I don't know necessarily we need more directors of the entities. For the Workforce Training Board, it says that the committee is made up of business and labor members, and so it might be interesting to hear from the members of a committee that actually compiled a list as to whether they have any thoughts as to, you know, whether it would have been harder to compile the list if the exemption wasn't there, if they had to let that be known that there was confidentiality or not. That might be more informative to us from the actual people who would have served on one of these committees, if we could find them.
Consider how we as committee people were processed onto this committee, a committee that up until now, I guess, has no real teeth in it, but we are going to make some recommendations and we're going to stand by them. I recall the considerable ink that was applied to Mr. Carr's selection as the chairman of this committee by the press and probably by street corner politicians. This committee doesn't have an axe to grind. It doesn't have a huge budget. Its mission is, until we discover it a little better and refine a little better, is a little obscure. And yet we were excruciatingly public. Now why do these other boards and commissions escape that same scrutiny? Help me out.
There is a tension, and this is the tension that we're addressing. And I think that the reason the legislature created this committee was for us to advise on just this sort of issue. There is a policy reason to exempt all applications for public employment, and that's that anybody looking for a job generally doesn't want their current employer to know it. And the balance that the reason that I voted for the change was, I believe, when you get to agency head, the balance for the public's need to know about those choices outweighs the risk that you're not going to get good candidates. And I think we have to weigh each of those as we discuss these. And that's why I personally wanted to draw the line there. I'm not sure about this yet. I don't know enough about these boards and the comments that we've gotten. And I did get that. I'm sorry, I didn't remember it, but I did get that. What we know already, which is that you're going to get a deeper pool if you don't disclose the pool. We know that. The question that has to be answered is the public's interest in these positions sufficient to outweigh that policy? And that's the balance that I think we should apply. Mr. Ford.
I think there's a point here that we should also look at is that the committees that are coming up with these lists are not the agency that are making the hiring decision. These committees are composed of business and labor appointees. So when these committees come up with this list of people that they would like to be hired, this is not some closely held government secret. This is the business community getting together and the labor community getting together and saying, hey, we'd like Joe Schmo to be, or Susie Green to be the appointee. I mean, this is not a state secret. This is a public committee. So, I mean, I haven't made any decisions, but that's my impression from reading the statute, is that this is unlike a government agency reviewing applications for employment. This is the public putting together a list that happens to be appointed to a committee.
Ms. Jacks.
Mr. Chair, I think that maybe Mr. Ford's comments make it almost persuasive that then they should, if the public is choosing the list, then the public should be able to see the finalists of the list at some point. Seems to me that follows with that sort of logic. And obviously I don't think anyone's trying to hide anything here. My guess is that maybe it's because of that little language that says the governor may reject that and ask for another pool that makes it maybe that they don't want to know who the rejected list is. And that may be, again, that is probably part, like Mr. Remmerman said, is part of the process, so we probably would never see that anyway, that rejected list. We would just see the final list to release to the public, if that's consistent with what we've passed so far, what we've considered so far.
I did a little bit of research. I didn't bring it along with me because I didn't know the questions would head in this direction, but I did a little bit of research on the Workforce Training Board, looked at their website. I think it's a board that is a part-time board or, you know, virtually a volunteer board that directs the executive director. And the executive director, in turn, directs the agency. I didn't count the number of employees at the Workforce Training Board, but eyeballing it was at least 20 employees. So we are talking a small agency with respect to the Workforce Training Board, and I'm just not familiar enough Recreation and Conservation Funding Board to know if it functions more like an advisory committee or more like an agency. And maybe that's something we need to do is get more information along those lines, if that's going to be critical to the committee making the decision of where it wants to go with these.
Are these really the only two boards that are chosen in this way, or are there another? This is it.
These are the two boards. These are the two boards that have an exemption like this. Through personal experience, I know of another board that is chosen in a similar way, where labor and business get together and come up with a list of three, and that particular agency does not have an exemption like this.
Do we know at all whether they consider that list exempt or not, just under the general application exemption?
I don't know what their practice is, or if they've ever even had a request for the list.
In that other board you're talking about, is who actually selects?
The governor.
Any other discussion? I have a suggestion for a way to proceed. Mr. Bunting has suggested that he would like to see these gone. I don't know if that's going to carry that's going to be the view of the committee, but I'm prepared to write a one-line recommendation that we place on the table for the next meeting to discuss that recommendation and consider that as part as the recommendation, and the committee can vote on it in the April meeting. So we can have a more detailed discussion. We can email the heads of the agencies and see if they want to comment and have something substantive. But I mean, it doesn't seem like there's much interest in changing them. The exemptions are either there or they're not, and we can go forward with a recommendation that they be removed. And Mr. Rahman's view is well taken, that it's probably covered right now by the original language in the applications for public employment exemption. But once we create the exemption to the exclusion to the exemption, they may not be covered any longer, and that would affect all of these similar boards. But if we don't remove these, then the intent, as Mr. Bunting said, of our removal wouldn't apply to these two very specific positions. Mr. Ford.
I'm not clear that the process means it would be covered by the applications for public employment. I guess maybe we could get some clarification on that. I understand that these are just lists that are created and given to the governor, but I'm not clear as to what the other process is, and if there is an application process that precedes the creation of a list, I don't know.
And Mr. Carr expressed my position pretty clearly. I mean, I do think I'd like to see these gone, but you know, I'm open-minded. I'd like to hear why a list created by special interest and given to the governor for an appointment to a fairly significant position ought to be exempt. And at this point, I don't understand why it's exempt.
One more quick comment. I wouldn't construe a list created by labor and business to be the same thing as what is covered by the applications for employment. Those are recommendations from two private sectors that represent public interest or private interests.
Okay. So is it the sense of the committee that we continue this discussion based on a recommendation for removal, and then we have a vote on at our April meeting? Mr. Ehrman.
Yes, I'm not disagreeing with that, but I did like the idea if we can get someone from these committees, mm-hmm. not just the agency, but the actual committees that made the selection, to hear what their view is on it and how important confidentiality is. The fact that there's mm-hmm. at least one other agency that doesn't have this confidentiality makes me think it might not be an important thing.
Okay. Any other discussion? I believe that completes the business on the agenda. Any other business to come before? Any discussion?
No, I wanted to thank whoever put the signs up, because after spending all that time on the freeway, it would have been horrible for me to walk around here.
I guess we're adjourned. Our next, Mr. Bunting.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to, there's a measure pending in the legislature, House Bill 3231. I think it may be fairly close to death. However, it does relate to the attorney work product rule in the legislature. And I was hoping that we could take a position on that, because I think it's a matter of public interest, and given the policy we adopted earlier, that we would take a peek at that we would take give 30 days for people to look at positions we're taking. I'd like just like to throw out that maybe we could consider a position on House Bill 3231.
Well, unfortunately, I'm going to have to step in here and say,
please,
we are treating this as a special meeting under the Open Public Meetings Act, because we had to change the published time of the meeting. And so I think that the legally safe course here is to not stray from the agenda and take on topics that are not on the agenda.
Can we discuss something without taking action on it? Or is it discussion alone.
Discussion can be action.
Well, I know discussion needs action, but as far as the limitations for special meetings, if we aren't taking any final action on it, are we prohibited from even discussing it?
Well, I think the argument is there, and then as I understood Mr. Bunting's proposal, he wanted to take a position.
No, Gina, I was suggesting we take a position on this 30 days from now, that we put it on
the
agenda.
I'm sorry.
For a future meeting so that we can take a position on it. Though I probably already have a position. But
wouldn't it? So, but it would be moot for this legislative session. I mean, I'm happy to.
That's true.
I'm happy to put. I mean, what we can do is if you like, we can reorder the. The Attorney General's office has prepared a new spreadsheet of exemptions, and the civil discovery exemption is on here, I assume, somewhere. If you want to move that up for discussion on the thing, we can do that and make it at an earlier meeting. That it's, I don't know where it is on the list right now without looking, but we could put that, and if you want, put it on the agenda for the next meeting.
Right. And right now, it is not on the schedule of review at all because it's only the things that the committee has said it wants to take up in the order it wants to take them up. There's two different spreadsheets there. One is the schedule by which you will consider exemptions. So one through, I think we're up to 20-something right now. And then the other is actually composed of several spreadsheets. It organizes the exemptions by category. And so you will find that exemption in one of the categories. The bylaws of the committee allow any member to ask the chair to put something on the agenda for the next meeting. And even if something isn't currently scheduled, you could ask the chair to put it on the agenda and change the schedule at the next meeting. So that doesn't have to be done at a meeting. At any point before the agenda is finalized, any member can email the chair and ask to have something put on the agenda.
So I will take that as the suggestion that we put the civil discovery exemption on the agenda for the next meeting. That'll be interesting. Because I have some thoughts about that, too.
Why does that not surprise me?
We've heard something about that, haven't we?
Any other discussion? Any other items people want? Anything people want on the agenda for the next meeting, please just let me know and we'll put it on there. Thank you all for coming. Thank you. I'm sorry the legislators couldn't be here, but we knew that there was a likelihood.
Do we have other night meetings because of the legislator schedule, or this is the only one, right?
This is the only one. This is the only mid-session meeting. The next meeting is scheduled for after session, assuming they end on time.
And that's a regular meeting.
And that would be a regular meeting. Mr. Correct.
Not to prolong it, but are we going to reconsider scheduling a meeting in Eastern Washington between now and the end of the year?
Yes. Absolutely.
And maybe at the March meeting, we should make a decision about what month that's going to be. And so Cynthia can start finding a place for us. I think we're scheduled in June, through June in Olympia, but, you know, that can change. But then certainly after June, no room reservations have been made, so July in Spokane?
Let's not go in July and August.
Oh.
Well, let's see. Mr. Thompson, did you want to add something?
Without an R in it, it's possible. There's a lot of snow up.
Yeah, June might be a good one.
Right. Well, let's consider that at our next meeting. And also, if anybody has any suggestions about where in Eastern Washington we should go. I know Ms. Jackson, Spokane. Spokane's also a big place. We would need a meeting place. So any thoughts you might have about where in the city of Spokane?
Oh, sure.
We have
a lot of
We've had sessions at Spokane Falls Community College. Excellent. It's just a little bit on the west side of town, so you don't have to go right into town.
Okay. So does the committee want Cynthia to start looking at June in the libraries or the Spokane Falls Community College?
I would say someplace really close to the airport so that if we're going to go out there, we don't have to rent cars too. And we're going to fly out there.
Okay. I think at the airport is the hotel. It's not just a hotel there.
Well, perhaps what we could do is either get arrange for shuttles or just rent one car and drive them together.
We go to the casino.
Two cars. I believe we're adjourned.
I think so.
Thank you.